Yeah.
Test, test.
Perfect.
That was clear.
Thank you.
Hi, Andrea. My name's Rose.
You said that one? How are you?
I'd like to call this, call the meeting to order. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the delegation's public hearing, where we will be hearing from Broward constitutional officers and on issues pertaining to the criminal and juvenile justice. I'm going to ask you to stand for the pledge at this time. And Rep. Jenny, would you please lead us?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Faith, would you please call the roll?
Senator Ring, Senator Sobel, Senator Sacks, Senator Brannan, Representative Moritas, Representative DuBose, Representative Rogers,
here.
Representative Jacobs, Representative Moskowitz, Representative Edwards, Representative Jenny,
here.
Representative Geller, Representative Jones, Representative Pritchett, Representative Diaz, Representative Stark, Representative Trujillo, Representative Clark Reed,
here.
Senator Smith. Okay.
Thank you very much, David. At this time, we will have a welcome from Mayor Mike Ryan, City of Sunrise. Mayor Ryan.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the delegation. I know that it's been such a busy season already, but traditionally it has not been. So I recognize how precious your time is. We in City of Sunrise truly appreciate your dedication, your commitment to coming to our Civic Center and inviting the public to be involved in this, particularly on the important issues that you're going to discuss today. We are on the front lines of the issues that you discuss, and I know you have great sensitivity to that. So it's, for us, a very meaningful opportunity to engage directly. And I welcome the public, I welcome the delegation, and I thank you for your hard work in Tallahassee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Is there a question for the mayor?
Yes, there's a question. How's this turn on?
It's on.
It's on. Mr. Mayor, I'm sorry, I just got here. Could you start over? Well, that's fine. Thank you for addressing us. We're glad to be here.
No, we're thrilled that you continue to think of us. We're always available should you ever want any public hearings on any matter. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mayor Ryan. It's always good to see you. And Representative Stark has joined us, so thank you very much. And we're going to move right into our public hearing. We're going to first hear from the constitutional officers on their liaison for approximately 5 minutes each. We would appreciate your cooperation by turning off your cell phones or putting them on vibrate so that they will not interrupt the meeting with phones ringing. Thank you. If there's anyone in the audience who has the desire to speak, you can go over to the table and register with Faith Lombardo, and she will be very happy to sign you up and we'll put you on the agenda. At this time, I'm going to ask for Dr. Snipes, the Supervisor of Elections Office, or her representative. Anyone here? Okay, we're going to move right along. If someone should come in, we will try and insert them elsewhere in the agenda. The clerk of the courts, Howard Foreman.
Here.
17th Judicial District.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Representatives and senators, I'm sure some senators will come very shortly too. Thank you very much for inviting me today. You know, when I usually approach all of you, I talk to you about all the neat little things about technology that the clerk's office is doing or other constitutional officers in the courthouse are doing too. We went through electronic filing, that was a totally complete thing. We have access to case information, and it's for free, and everybody was happy about that, especially the legal community. And one thing also, we're working on a new app that's very useful. We can get all kinds of information very quickly from your iPhones. All these things really gave a whole lot of impetus and a whole lot of convenience for the public. And that's all well and good, but if you don't have an adequate staff to make these things work, everything will slow down no matter how scintillating or great that it sounds. And as a result of clerks being not funded properly, this year, this is the third session in the last seven sessions where the legislature had us come up short. If we're not adequately funded, we have to make the difficult decisions regarding the operations of the clerk's offices around the state, forcing some to implement furloughs, like we did, reduce hours of operation, like we did, initiate employee layoffs, same here, in order to accommodate the budget cut. The impact of a 5% budget cut to us and all the other 66 clerks in the state of Florida, you would expect some of them to affect different counties differently because there's very large counties like a Valley or a Dade or a Palm Beach. There's middle-sized counties, and there's little small counties too. But what does not differ from county to county is the fact that a continued lapse in funding the Florida clerks will result in a negative impact on the commerce and the public safety at the local level in every county in Florida. Broward's implementation of the 5% cut to the balance of the first part of the last fiscal year equaled $2 million cut. If we really come down to it, in those 3 months, that was like a 21% cut, cut our budget. Also, as a result of the budget cuts, we have implemented one unpaid furlough a month. We cut 17 positions, no longer here. One heartbreaking thing is an additional 26 employees resigned on their own. I just saw a young lady, she had tears in her eyes today. I hate to leave, but they're going to give me another $4 an hour. So I'd love to keep you, but I can't leave. People come to me and say, that furlough day, although I'm glad we initiated them, or else we'd have to cut more people, for the budget, it would be worse. The lady came to me in tears. One year a month for that furlough. I may not be able to pay my rent. I had a couple of employees come to me and say, I don't know if I can afford to send my kid to college this year. Real life happens, not just in the clerk's office, but in every office in the state of Florida that's not funded properly. Also in Broward County, besides the furlough and 17 positions and 26 resignations, I'm concerned that this situation will reduce our ability
Timer. 1 minute. Just wrap up.
Okay, I'll be happy to wrap up. It's going to hurt, it's going to hurt public safety, and it's going to hurt business because cases have to be moved right along. We also closed, get away with overtime. We close down the offices an hour early in order to catch up with the work that they have to do without overtime. We close three branches, two of the DMV offices, and we had to close down Brick Gates, you know, out in far western Navy. So what we desperately need, you know, from the legislature, as I gave you in the paper, is we need a surefire way to fund the clerk's offices now on in. If we don't, we're going to have this every 2 years, something else is going to happen. It's not fair, because we work with the court system, we work with the sheriff, we work with the public defender, we work with the state attorney, and we all work arm in arm to give people justice in a timely, proper fashion. I know that we will begin a dialogue with many of the leadership in the Senate and the House, and please work with them. We greatly appreciate all of our constituents, your constituents, and I'm sure they told you the same. Mayor Shannon, thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much, Senator. Any questions for Clerk of Court? Yes, Representative Ryan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Clerk, we're so happy that you're here telling us what you tell us whenever you come to Tallahassee. But as you indicated, you're having discussions with the leadership in Tallahassee. Do you offer a solution other than returning fees that you collect locally that would sustain us other than that?
Well, that's one big issue. In the 2009 session, when we had the first big budget cut, a lot of the money that was designated to the clerk's office was taken away. I think that's the first place that you look. You know, if there's some efficiencies to be created, we'll do them too. During the budget, before the bill was kicked up serious, and even afterward, we had the support of the Senate, and we didn't have the support of the House. I'm not talking about the four of you. You know what I mean? And just like the Medicaid issue, you know, they kept locking horns on Park Street, and nothing happened. And we just can't go through that again.
Still, as it relates to the foreclosure department, I know you handle a lot of foreclosures.
Yes.
Can you tell me that line item or that department is self-supporting? Do you get a return revenue?
No, it never is, because the foreclosure is a very intense, you know, kind of case to go through. And for a couple of years, the state of Florida gave the courts and the clerks money to help with foreclosures. That money's gone now. Now, way back when, like in 2009, 2010, there were like, for a couple of years, we had 50,000 foreclosures in Broward, 45,000 foreclosures in Broward. Now it's down to 20. Still a lot. And there's still, believe it or not, a little backlog that exists, you know, probably. So it's a very intense kind of case. And I know that Judge Weinstein hired some retired judges to help along, and judges that are on the docket now. And if we got some more money from Tallahassee to clean the whole thing up, it would help.
On that same note, how much money are we talking about from Tallahassee to clean up that? How much do you approximately believe you needed?
Well, our county got 700,000 last time, and we're 10% of the population, probably 2 to 3 million, because Broward County is very intense as far as litigation is concerned. Your five big counties is where the bulk of the litigation comes from. And we're, of course, we'll be funded more than some small counties that hardly have any foreclosures in them. Probably something like 2, 3, 4.
Thank you very much, Senator Foreman, and we will see how it moves along. You know, some those of us who are sitting here are not in leadership.
All four of us will vote for this all the time.
We will. Representative Starr.
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate, thank you, Madam Chair, that, you know, we've been going through this the last few years, and we understand the needs of the courts. I spoke to Judge Weinstein and myself, and we're going to continue to, you know, do what we can to try to increase the funding. You know, I mean, I thank you for bringing the, you know, figures for us to take a look at. You know, of course, you know, sometimes we have a little bit of a differing opinion on how the money should be allocated from from the governor's office and some of the leadership, but, we understand that we really do want to do the best that we can for you. We're just going to keep trying. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next would be Katie Pugh, Court Administrator, 17th Judicial Circuit. Here, anyone representing? Okay, moving right along. Chief Assistant Public Defender, Brown County Public Defender's Office, Gordon Weeks.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Chairman, members of the delegation, I just want to talk about three issues that seem to be very important for either the criminal justice system or the juvenile justice system. One being conditions of confinement. Here in Broward County, we have a number of juvenile programs. Over the years, we've learned that some of these programs are not offering a high level or high quality of care. There have been a number of abuses that have been reported in the media. It goes all the way back to a program that was located in Pembroke Pines, Thompson Academy. There were a number of lawsuits involving that program. That program was ultimately shut down. Some years thereafter, mental health facility, Citrus Mental Health. It is an intensive treatment facility for young boys and young girls. That facility was engaging in such deplorable practices that they were sedating children, four-point restraining them, and allowing them to be restrained for a significant period of time. These were children that had already been subjected to abuse, children that suffered from mental illness, and that process was once again traumatizing those children. Complaints were made, investigations were made, but those conditions similar still occur. It's recently been brought to our attention and reported in the media. Group homes in Fort Lauderdale have also been the focal point of human trafficking in this community, where everyone knows where these young girls reside. They know that they're vulnerable. They know that they have significant trauma. Everyone is preying upon them. And sometimes it seems that the system is preying upon them as well because we're not offering or providing or affording them a safe place, even though they are products of the system. These children are removed from their home through abuse, famine, and neglect, and then they're placed in a situation that's causing them to be abused, abandoned, and neglected again. The second issue I would like to, the point behind that is there needs to be some considerable attention brought to the conditions that we are placing our children into when we place them in facilities all throughout the world. This is not isolated only in Broward County. These types of occurrences occur all throughout Florida in all types of facilities, detention facilities, commitment facilities, rehabilitation facilities. Our sister family to the south had a child die in the detention center. It was reported in the news some weeks ago. Our neighboring county to the north had a child die 2 years ago in their detention center. And the FDLE has been moving in to investigate how they are taking care of the children in the facility. So it's not exclusive to Broward County, it's occurring all across the state. Another issue that's very important to the Public Defender's Office, I believe to the community, is the issue of direct bombing. That is where a child is treated as an adult, even though they've engaged in conduct as a child. And they are criminalized and placed in the system and treated as though they were adults, even though they are under the age of majority. In those instances, we see that children are receiving disparate treatment in the system. And unfortunately, Broward County has a distinction of leaving the state last year in the number of children that were direct bombed. That is not something that we should continue to pursue. What we're asking initially, there was a bill that came to the legislature last year that we're trying to revise and readdress the direct bomb protocol, and that's something that really needs some consideration and it needs to be looked at. And the last issue that's brought a lot of attention within the community is excessive use of force by police. I know last year there were bills to address how to handle police body cameras and things of that sort. And there's been a slow rolling out of those body cameras throughout the police agencies in Broward County. But body cameras is not going to fix everything. It is one additional tool to address the excessive use of force. There's another issue with respect to body cameras that will supplement and help the body cameras, and that's to address the grand jury procedure when it comes to reviewing cases involving police officers' excessive use of force. The grand jury at present is a secret and private proceeding. It is exclusive to the state attorney, the court, and the grand jurors. Let states across the United States have been looking at that grand jury procedure. In California, a bill was passed and adopted into law that removed excessive use of force cases involving police officers from the grand jury and left that with the state attorney. We're asking you to take a look at a similar type bill to have the community have some insight into the process of weighing and considering what is going on with respect to police excessive use of force. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weeks, for coming and presenting this to us. Are there any questions for Mr. Weeks?
Thank you, and thank you for always looking out for our children. I wanted to bring you back to one of the challenges that you might be having most times. Group homes are not required to be registered, so you don't even know when they are moving into various communities. You don't know if it's an adult group home or one for children, until you see a lot of kids on the road, and they're in communities, and most often law enforcement will not know unless a complaint is filed. So maybe legislation that we might look at would require for them to be registered. So at least we know where they are and where children are before something happens. So I don't know what you think about that.
Registration is probably something that can assist in helping folks understand where these group homes are occurring. But what's very much needed is a level of oversight as to what occurs inside these group homes. And not only group homes, but mental health facilities and also juvenile treatment facilities all throughout the state of Florida. We need to have a more heightened level of accountability and supervision when it comes to reviewing what is occurring inside the facility. Leaving it up to a particular agency, whether it's DJJ, DCF, or the Agency of Healthcare Administration, that may not be enough. Then it may need to be a heightened level of scrutiny with respect to how children are being treated in these facilities. Thank you.
Mr. Weeks, you know of the ombudsman program that we have for our elders, where we have oversight by community persons. Do you think that an ombudsman program is needed for the mental health and juvenile facilities?
Most definitely. These children have no voice. Many of the parents are having difficulty themselves dealing with their life issues. They need to have a real voice that's outside of a particular agency. Sometimes we find that the agency has a vested interest in trying to resolve the issue of misconduct internally rather than truly trying to ferret it out and make sure that it doesn't reoccur. For example, the Department of Juvenile Justice oftentimes has privatized entire residential treatment facilities. And as a result, the company is seeking to resolve the abuse rather than having DJJ or some other agency come in and ferret out the abuse. So it becomes who's really watching the in-house, so to speak, and what's happening is our children are at risk all throughout the state of Florida.
Thank you very much for that comment. As far as safe houses in Broward County, it is my understanding that there are none for the human trafficking population. So, do you have a recommendation?
Very much so. You know, we oftentimes have our children move to communities far away from South Florida that are victims of people trafficking. And when a young child has to make a difficult decision to leave whatever family, however she can be here locally, to find some safe harbor far, far away, it becomes a very difficult decision. If we had a safe harbor facility here locally, it would make that decision a lot more palatable for these children that are trying to extract themselves from the human trafficking realm, but also trying to maintain a link to the family that they may have locally as well.
Bring back a question just to follow up. Are we still transporting kids outside of the state of Florida? Is that
still? To my knowledge, no children being transported outside of the state of Florida. There's a facility, I believe it's located in Central Florida for human trafficking victims. But I've had children express the desire to want to be close to whatever friends and family they may have with them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Board of Weeks, for your presentation. Bob Wolf from the Property Appraisers Office.
Good afternoon, members.
Good afternoon.
Behalf of Lori Parrish, the Broward County Property Appraiser, she just wanted to have me express our gratitude that the Broward Legislative Delegation unanimously supported our bill last year, HB 213. That was voted unanimously out of the legislature and signed by the governor. Representative Moritas presented her with a commemorative bill a week or two ago, and she's just thrilled. And we're putting it up on a prominent spot on the wall for her as memorial, so of her tenure. So thank you again. As far as issues this year, we don't really know what's going to go on. We've had, since we have a couple members of the Finance and Tax Committee, just want to make sure, feel free to call me anytime to get background on bills. It's going to be another crazy session, I'm sure. That value adjustment board situation just doesn't seem to go away. And I hope you noticed this week the Inspector General's report down in Miami-Dade pretty much laid the problem at the property appraiser's feet of the county clerk in Miami-Dade. And I'll be forwarding that AG's report, or Inspector General's report, to any members of the FMT committee for Broward County. So I think that's a great thing to weigh when that issue comes up this year. The only heartburn we're experiencing with taxpayers this year, as you all remember back in 2008, we enacted Amendment 1, which doubled the homestead exemption, created portability, but also created that 10% cap on non-homestead properties. We have an issue coming up now with escalating property values that we have folks that have property down here that are subject to the 10% cap, and then when they retire here and decide to homestead, we're killing them on assessments because their constitution still calls for us to raise the assessment of market value. And so back when Save Our Homes was enacted, that was two decades before we had a 10% cap on property. We have numerous cases right now where it was almost ridiculous to advise a taxpayer to homestead because of the penalties involved with the raising of assessment. And it's been happening all through different economic stratas. We've had people raising $100,000 up to $1 million. And I researching how to cure that legislatively is going to be very difficult because, if you know that's ensconced in the state constitution, we're thinking about getting a bill draft, maybe just pass around up in Tallahassee, and maybe when Chairman Gates and some of these other guys come up with, grandiose tax plans for this year, maybe that's something we can talk to them about, something that would help average people and not special interest groups. Because we really started hearing complaints about that. We haven't really talked to the property appraisers around the state yet. We're going to do a fiscal analysis on our tax roll to see how many properties we really were talking about, what the valuations were. But the dozens of issues that I dealt with personally were pretty significant. And that might be a problem for us going forward in the future. But any of the Constitution, if you know, is difficult. It's a portability of three or four tries to get on the ballot. So that's something we're going to look at. And again, I just want to be a resource to any of you members and your constituents. When you need us, we'll be there. Thank you again, Chairman, for allowing us to continue to use your district office. We are going to appreciate that over the next year, hopefully many more. and a related birthday wishes to Representative Rogers. I know that popped up on my smartphone today. Since we're Facebook friends, yes.
Thank you very much, Bob, and, you know, it's a pleasure to have the property appraiser there, and it's good for the constituents and, you know, just for anybody
right.
who happens to be in that community and needs to have some information on their properties or their family's properties when their state cases and those types.
And we're available to any member at any special event or any time meet us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
And say hello to Barney.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
We are now in the public hearing portion of our meeting. All speakers will be allotted 3 minutes each for their presentations. We're very pleased to have one of our constituents from Miami-Dade, sorry, constituents, one of our colleagues from the Miami-Dade delegation, our representative Jose Javier Rodriguez. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair, members, and everybody here present. Good morning. Good afternoon. Sorry. Jose Javier Rodriguez. I'm a state representative down in Miami, but I guess I kind of am a constituent a little bit. As many of you know, I work at a personal injury firm here in Broward, so I'm up in Broward most of the work week. And I wanted to, I guess, acknowledge the characterization Mr. Foreman made of our civil system here. It actually is very litigious, but hey, it is what it is. So the reason that I'm here before you, I know Rep. Stark was kind of grimacing like, why are you here? Briefly, I'm here as a member of the Miami-Dade delegation, and I wanted to give you all a heads up on a process that we're going through as a delegation. And I'll preface that by expressing in a personal sense, as somebody who served 3 years in the legislature, one of the things that's really frustrating is we try to develop and work on priorities for our region, and then we go back home and try to report on how they went. The bar is very, very low on a lot of the things that we're working on. What I mean by that is a lot of times the report backs that we do to groups, the media coverage, it tends to focus on, oh, you got $1 million for this project, or it was this, you know, crisis that you were able to avert by getting this statute passed or amended. But almost never is there an analysis on any long-term or strategic goals that we have as a region. And when I say Miami-Dade as a region, there's a lot of different things in Miami-Dade. But what I mean by that, for example, many of us remember the fight over school funding formulas that really hurt Broward and Miami-Dade many, many years ago, the district cost differential. And I mention that only because it's probably the best example of a strategic long-term change that was made that really hurt us, and something that a lot of us talk about, well, how could we work toward that? When you look at 24 members of the House, between the House and Senate, there are 24 members who represent some part of Miami-Dade. So there are almost a sixth of the legislature. If we really worked hard on a lot of these strategic long-term things, we could make an impact. And what we're doing is, our chair is Senator Anita de Flores, and she has appointed a committee which I'm serving on, and we're going to be working on these things. A lot of the priorities are likely to deal with transportation funding formulas, healthcare funding formulas, education funding formulas, and things, for example, dealing with citizens' property insurance. All of the things, I can't imagine a single thing that's probably going to come out of that committee that is not going to be equally beneficial to Broward County or to Palm Beach County. So just wanted to put that on your plate. We don't know what these priorities are. The committee's just been formed. We're still talking about how to work more effectively toward long-term strategic change for Miami. But again, I anticipate that a lot of the things that are going to be most impactful for us long-term as a delegation are going to be things that, frankly, you all can roll with. And are probably also priorities for you all. So I just wanted to let you guys know that. I appreciate your time and hopefully your collaboration.
Thank you very much, Representative, for coming up here. As you say, you are proud all work week and sharing that with us. Are there any questions or comments?
Just one comment.
I never grimace. No.
Representative Jenny? Thank you very much, and we will take under consideration what you're saying, so telling us, and hopefully when there are issues that both delegations will benefit from in some way, that we will be able to share those and be able to have a meaningful dialogue about the bill or the appropriation, whichever.
I appreciate it. Thank you for your time, and I'll see you until last.
Thank you. Next is Mark Snee, Board of Trustees Chair, and Jamie Payson for Girls. Thank you.
Madam Chair, yes, I'm Mark Snee, the Chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Pay Center for Girls across the state. And I just want to thank the delegation and all of the legislature for your continued support over the last 30 years that we've been operating in the state of Florida, and the 30,000 girls that we have helped find their voice, find their strength, and move on to a better life. And now I'm going to turn it over to the chair of our local board here in Broward, Jamie Venezuela.
Yes, good afternoon, Representative Clark Reed. You were, excuse me, and yes, you were smart to skip the Venezia, the difficult one. But I know we've met before. I'm an attorney here locally, and I am the chair of the board. I've been involved in our center for 22 years now, ever since Judge Melanie Bain once asked me to come and mentor, and I became involved forever since then. You'll see here today we have two lovely girls here from our center that got here with their amazing teacher here, Ms. Karen, and they're doing amazing work here right in Globe Manors. Specifically, what we're going to be doing is talking to you all up in Tallahassee when we come up again for our PACE days, when you see all the red shirts. And I know each of you have been wonderfully supportive, and I think we've met with you all individually. We're going to be asking for some funding, another $2.35 million in new funding for PACE. And precisely the reason why is just to follow up with my colleague, Gordon Weiss, who's doing a great job over there at the courthouse and the PD's office, and notices and sees the problems. We are one of the solutions. We're the solution he's talking about. It's happening right here in your own county and throughout our state and all of our centers. Specifically here in your own county, you can tell your constituents that you saved, you helped, and you can continue to save 489 girls here in Broward last year. That's just actual girls that would have gone into the system and would have gone downhill. And we can feel proud of that we're doing that. And the funding that we're asking you for will allow us to continue to do that, but reach even more girls. And specifically, I have fast facts, and I don't know how much time I'll be able to have to get all of this in, but I have a lot of literature I can give you to just tell you how many more girls we can serve now with this additional funding. But specifically, the recurring general revenue funds of $1.25 million would be served 250 girls more. And there's a lot of those types of numbers, but the bottom line is we're saving girls, you're helping us to do it, we want to save more. Our population is growing, and this amount that we are dealing with is actually 20% of the entire state of Florida girls. Our number of 489 is 20% of the entire state. So a lot of it is happening here in Broward, and we're doing it, and we need the funding to continue to do it. We thank you.
Thank you very much for coming and presenting to us. And PACE Center is very near to all of our hearts, because we know that you're doing a good job, an excellent job of what you're doing. You just don't have enough hours in the day or enough funding to move the programs along. And I would like to ask Public Defender Weeks if this is one of the programs that you would like to see replicated and continued, and isn't doing very well with our young ladies. Thank you very much. Yes. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. And the young ladies that come up to Tallahassee, we enjoy seeing you and having you come to our offices. And I enjoy coming to PACE all the time. You know, my friends are there.
Okay. We love having you. We love you. And we welcome all of you to come who's never been there to come and see what we're doing and what you all are helping to accomplish daily.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Trevor and Andy, forgive me for not pronouncing your name correctly, Trevor. You will correct me, I'm sure. Assistance with the court system.
Good afternoon, members of the Broward delegation, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Trevor Adeen, and last December 2nd, 2014, I appeared before you and requested that you take steps to overturn the fraudulent final judgment of my divorce, conspired among my now ex-wife Doris Adeen, attorney Jeffrey Miller, and Judge Judith Krieger against me in Broward County courts. To date, none of the 22 members of your delegation has responded to my plight. And after my many attempts to resolve this matter, I was led back to this delegation. I am again requesting that you plead with the Florida Bar to file a petition in the Supreme Court to overturn this final judgment and render punishments to these criminals as they relate to law and moral conduct. The responsibility and authority they now have. Mr. Siegel, the Broward attorney, took this approach, and the Supreme Court ruled against Mr. Miller for other less reprehensible acts, for which he was punished for his crimes. I beseech the Florida Bar to take this approach as well, but they ignored me. To be fair, this privilege must be extended to citizens in my situation, and not only to the legal fraternity for gross negligence by the criminal justice system, hence my request. In my matter, the criminal justice system made an error in judgment, and it is their obligation to correct it by principle and law, and not to put that burden upon me. If not, citizens will mistrust the criminal justice system as they have been doing. My contact with them after 3 years with every legal authority in the state to correct this wrong failed, as they claim to have no authority for this error. Imagine the highest legal authorities who are the developers and administrators of the law have no authority to correct an error in a system they have created. The damage for their gross negligence has caused me to be at the brink of hopelessness. In addition, the criminal justice's failure has allowed the perpetrators of this crime to enjoy a windfall of my assets. The only thing I now have left is my integrity. What a country. In the 21-page handout from me, you will find that the criminal justice system has failed miserably, as it allowed these officers a free hand to manipulate it without any accountability and responsibility by them. These officers are playing hide and seek with the responsibilities bestowed upon them. Apparently, there is no oversight responsibilities by the Supreme Court, Florida Bar, and the Judicial Qualification Commission for these officers' criminal activity. Legislators, you hold a sacred responsibility of representing your constituents. They depend on you for your guidance and trust so that they will obtain fairness and equality without fear.
Mr. Adkern, I'm going to have to stop you because the buzzer has already rang and you're 3 minutes up and I can let you go on a little bit longer. What I can say to you is that this is an ongoing case and we really have no jurisdiction over this matter. Sorry that you're in the predicament you're in, but this legislative delegation cannot act on this.
What is my recourse?
Yeah, I'm just taking a look here. I mean, I have to really take a look at this a little further. I'm happy to be an insurance agent, so a little bit of that annuities. But you know, if you think that there's something not legal or not lawful, I mean, have you spoken to the Department of Insurance?
It's not only about the insurance. That's part of the issue because they took all my assets, and that's the supporting documentation for it.
The only other thing I see, though, is that this annuity and life insurance company is located in Des Moines, Iowa, and the Florida Department of Insurance may or may not have any jurisdiction on that. They usually have some jurisdiction on, because the annuity is written by an insurance company, so they may have some jurisdiction over that they're doing. Is this purchased in our state?
The problem is not with the annuity right now, that's part of the problem. The problem is the false financial affidavit that was submitted in the court in my absence, because if you read the handout, you will see a 22-page handout I have there, you will see the whole issue.
Yes, by the way, I want to apologize myself for not really looking at this closely. As an insurance agent, I get a lot of solicitations for annuities, buying annuity companies and doing business with them. I saw this, I know this is a solicitation today to do business with this insurance company. So my apologies, I'll take a look at this myself. But what our chair said is correct. This is probably not something that we can do, but as an insurance agent, I do a lot of work with people having to do with things with that theory. Because an annuity is an insurance product. And I can't say that I really can do something for you here, but I would like to investigate this and see if there is something I can do, or at least give a point in the right direction. And I do understand that there's a matter of either a criminal intent or fraud or something here.
To me, that's the first issue to be resolved. Once that is resolved, the rest of it will follow. But I don't know what else recourse I have to pursue this matter.
Any law enforcement agencies looking at this?
Well, this is beyond the law enforcement. It's a criminal justice system.
All right, Ms. Dagner, as I said before, because you have this as a legal document, a legal map issue, the legislative delegation cannot really intercede in this. As a delegation, we cannot intercede in this.
Yeah, but my question is, I've gone through all the processes to the highest level in the state, and no one seems to know what to do.
I can't answer that question, sir.
Well, what's in my next step then?
We can only say to you that you are dealing with the legal system, you are dealing with the courts, and that's your remedy. Well, but this delegation cannot intercede in any way in this matter, sir. That's what I'm telling you.
Well, then you can provide some guidance for me to address this matter.
The only guidance we can provide to you is that to go back to the courts and open the case, continue with the case. You have an attorney?
I don't have an attorney. They took all of my assets, so I don't
There's
have...
There's a public, legal aid?
Legal aid is the one who actually did this and they messed up the whole thing.
Sir, I'm sorry, but I don't know what to tell you then, but we have no jurisdiction in this matter at all.
Actually, if I have to go back to the same system that has convicted and made a false judgment, I mean, I'm going back into another trap. That's what it amounts to.
I'm sorry that that is the situation the way it is, but as I said, we have no no jurisdiction in this matter at all.
So what am I to do?
Sir, I have said to you, you need to go back to the judicial system. You need to find yourself another attorney, possibly, and go back. If you have to do it again, maybe that person will do it differently and you'll get the results that you want. But we have no jurisdiction in this matter. All right.
Thank you.
James Ingersoll, Fort Lauderdale Police and Firefighters Retirees Association.
Thank you, Chair. Ladies and gentlemen, I haven't spoken in front of anybody in 20 years, so bear with me. And I want to thank you for your public service as a retired firefighter. I know what that means. I have a problem for the 1,000 people that I represent as the retirees of the Fort Lauderdale Firefighters and Police Pension System. We have a COLA in our pension plan that started in 1972 when the Broward delegation started that same year. We've only had COLAs for 40% of the time. We have had no COLAs for the last 15 years. And the only reason we can't get a COLA is because of the quirk in the state law, which is state statute chapter 112.61 and chapter 1994-259. And we've been trying, working with the city and with the pension board for Lauderdale and our attorneys on both sides, on the retiree side and the pension board side. And we cannot get two attorneys to agree with the same wording. on what it means, and we keep going back and forth for 4 years. Our solution is if we can get a change in the state law on the wording under chapter 10261 and 94259, it would change the actuarial assumptions, gains and losses, on how the actuarial figures what you have in your pension plan. Fort Lauderdale has over $800 million in their pension plan. It's 97% funded. There's no problems with the pension plan. It has won awards for years from all the organizations that manage and supervise pension plans in the state of Florida, including the teachers' division that they take care of. This does not impact FRS, which is your pension plan that you have, and it's a great plan. It pays a 3% COLA every year under FRS. Under the chapter plans, 175 and 185, police and fire, there's different rules, and we live with them. And we paid in for a COLA 7% of our salary for 20, 30 years, and we expected a COLA. Now, all of a sudden, we don't have a COLA. We're told we can't have one because the state statute says we can't, just the way they add up money actuarially, not the way it works in the real world, where you make your 7.5% return or 10% return. The actuarial returns are less than what the real returns are. And the state law makes you compound down any losses, so you have to gain enough money to pay off those losses. Fort Lauderdale's on paper loss is $120 to $130 million. That means that we have to make our 7.5% plus 20% every year for 10 years to pay that off, which is an impossibility. So I'm looking for something that won't cost the state any money, but it will help the 1,000 retirees of Fort Lauderdale, probably many other plans that are caught in the same position.
Let me ask you, thank you very much for your presentation, Ms. Ingersoll. Do you have language that you're providing for us, the language that needs to be changed and what it needs to be changed to?
No, after 20 years, I'm kind of new to how the procedures work, so I was thinking when I'm here, I should have that. And I would go with our attorney, get some language and present that to you all. Would that be?
Yes, that would help the situation, you know, give us something to look at and give our bill drafting something to look at to see if those changes can be made in those statutes. So that would be my recommendation to you. Does anyone else have Rep. Rogers?
Thank you. Also, Governor, I want to suggest that you talk to one of your state reps, because unless you're having a delegation bill, then you need to have a sponsor from the city of Fort Lauderdale to cannabis legislation. There's also a deadline for making sure we submit bills.
Right? What is that deadline, if I may ask?
It was August 21st.
Okay, I just know there's a deadline, whether or not it was given to us.
Well, the local bill, if it's going to be a local bill, it's past the deadline, what you can do is to speak to your state rep, and maybe they will look at your language and carry a bill that will do what you need to have done, or wait until next year and file, get into the local bill process when before the deadline, and you know, have a local bill filed.
And it could be an amendment to an existing bill?
Oh, yes, you can always amend, yes.
Thank you for your time and your service, and we like to serve and protect the public. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Michelle Gale. Dr. Gale.
Good evening. Okay. You can start with some general information about fracking and get right to what you need to know. Fracking is associated with a significant increase in hospitalizations in two counties in Pennsylvania. These areas saw a 49% increase in cancer-related hospitalizations and over $2.5 million worth of additional cancer-related costs in 4 years' time. translated to an area the size of Broward County, that would amount to a $43 million increase in cancer-related expenses. Increases in hospitalizations that large and larger occurred in neonatology, neurology, and several other specialties. These results are in line with others that prove that fracking has profound public health and economic consequences. Not to mention that one average frack well uses enough water to last 7 Floridians their entire lives, or that well over 1,000 cases of fracking-related water contamination have been documented, or that Colorado has over 100,000 fracked wells, and on a summer day, the air in Denver looks like that in Beijing. Senator Richter is sponsoring SB 318, which has been presented as a means of strengthening the regulatory framework governing the oil and gas industry in Florida. Representative Rodriguez is sponsoring HB 191, a companion bill. These bills would strip municipalities and counties of home rule and leave local governments powerless to protect their communities from an industry that destroys lives. No amount of oversight can make fracking safe. Most concrete well casings leak. Frackers drill right through aquifers with dirty drill bits. The EPA found evidence of more than 36,000 oil spills in the U.S. in 6 years' time. Excess gas is released right into the atmosphere, polluting air and increasing already spiraling temperatures with alarming implications for sea level rise. Wow. I've got a bit more to go. May I finish?
I'll give you 1 minute.
All right. SB 318 doesn't include a trade secrets exemption. It requires drill operators to disclose all chemicals to the DEP. But this appears to be immaterial in light of the fact that Senator Richter is drafting another bill, SB 182, that would evidently prevent the DEP from disclosing that information. Together, the bills would effectively force Floridians to undergo fracking and prevent disclosure of the identity of the chemicals involved in the event of a disaster, and they throw the door to fracking in Florida wide open. The statewide coalition of environmental groups urges you to support SB 166, Senator Soto's bill to ban fracking in Florida, and Representative Jenny's companion bill, HB 19. Please join us in our unequivocal opposition to Senator Richter's SB 318 and Representative Rodriguez's HB 191. Floridian cities and counties have passed 47 anti-fracking resolutions and some ordinances. Please help us turn the momentum we're generating into the tipping point that makes a statewide ban feasible.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And Representative Jenny, I heard your name mentioned. Would you like to comment?
Yeah, well, thank you for coming. I think you probably already figured out that we're like-minded on this particular
yes.
subject. You know, and I've read the bill already. Representative Brett, obviously being in the House, I concern myself with the House version. And I've read Representative Rodriguez's bill on it. And, you know, there's a lot to read in there. But there's also a lot of, feints and smoke and mirrors, if you will, from the fact that based on our geology, we would actually have to use a process known as acidization more than traditional fracking. But when you look at the bill, the word acidization doesn't appear once in it. That being the fact of the matter, the scientific fact of the matter, in all reality, most of what would go on in the new wells would be completely unregulated because they would be using acidization, which isn't covered anywhere in Florida statute if this bill were to pass. We got lucky last year. It died when the House of Representatives decided to walk over. No one here voted for it. But as a body, the decision was made to walk away from session early, in fact, that it was unconstitutional. The Supreme Court ruled later that week. But that being the fact, one of the good things that happened was that bill died. Now, we know it's going to be an uphill fight, but I can tell you it seems like more and more people are becoming knowledgeable on the subject, and I think that's one of the things that's helping us as that more and more people kind of see, you know, it's probably not the best way to go when you look at some of the statistics on fracking, especially when most wells dry up within 3 to 5 years. It's not a long-term solution. And, you know, a lot of this is tied to offshore drilling as well. A lot of the companies that want to do this are simultaneously pushing that. You see that in the information that's sent around by these conglomerates promoting the job increases that the people. If you look at the little fine print, it's not fracking, it's fracking and offshore drilling. So there's a lot to it. There's a lot going on. And there's a lot of money to interest. I mean, you know, it's, I joke around that. Just taking on one multi-billion dollar industry wasn't enough for me. I had to find a new one when I came back and found myself in discussing fracking a lot more. But I can tell you there's a lot of folks. I know Representative Stark has emailed me late at night about fracking and about different things that are going on. So, you know, there's a lot of people that are taking a lot of interest in it. And every day I think the chamber and really the community as a whole in Florida are becoming more educated on it, and with the things that you're doing coming forward and talking like this, you know, especially, I mean, for someone on the dais as informed, so that you're doing a great service. So thank you for that, and it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Does Representative Rodriguez's bill not address well stimulation?
It does. Traditional fracking is covered in it, but really it's just the backdoor. Right now, if you're looking, there's not fracking going on. Every time somebody's tried to frack someplace, DEP has stepped in and shut it down relatively quick. But even still, in that relatively quick, we know now that the site that was shut down in Collier was only open for a day or two. 8,000 gallons of hydrochloric acid were pumped into the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Or excuse me, 8,000. I exaggerated heavily there by accident. But even 8,000 gallons of hydrochloric acid went into the Everglades. That fact is not disputed. That's what happened. So, DEP. So it's kind of, we need to regulate this, but it's not happening right now. So the regulation is really just a green light for them to go through. And if you look at the penalties attached to illegal, what would be cut outside of the regulation, you're talking about a fine of $25,000 on a site that's going to make tens of millions of dollars every year. It would pay at that point. I mean, you would be better off not adhering to safety standards. It's a simple addition, subtraction, and cost analysis. $25,000 for the fine means nothing when you're going to pull in 8 figures each year.
I questioned the DEP about that, and they wrote back that's our maximum fine.
And legislatively, statutorily speaking, they are absolutely, they were not fitting. That was in no way, shape, trying to hide the truth. That is the truth. That's what it is. But we'll have, this, look, my bill isn't going to be heard. I want you to know that up front. The ban will not be heard. We need to get it on the ballot. That's the way that we're going to have to do this. I just want to be honest with you. They won't hear this bill. They're more interested in bringing the money. I know it's not what you want to hear. It's not what I want to hear.
But we don't have $10 million.
Agreed.
We don't have that.
That's one
we
of
have
the,
nothing.
So the goal is to continue educating people and make it politically unbearable for anyone to vote for this. I have some amendments when this bill comes to the floor that are going to be so unpalatable and so shameful for anyone to vote against that there will be repercussions no matter where someone lives in the state. Based on the amendments that I've already drafted up here right now.
Thank
yes, ma'am.
They are hundreds of people.
Tens of thousands, to be quite frank.
Okay, I know hundreds.
You know hundreds all by yourself, but yes. There's tens of thousands. Thank you.
Yes, excuse me, could you come back?
Doctor,
come back.
Yeah, I just wanted to add in there is another bill that's going to be presented against fracking. It's going to be Representative Rodriguez that was here earlier from Dade County and Senator Ring are going to be proposing a bill to actually have a referendum against fracking. I think they're looking to put it in the state constitution. I don't know how that's going to do, but I'm just telling you that that's going to be presented this year.
What Senator Ring told me was, we're going to do it this way because this is the only way it's going to get done, but it's not going to pass and you're going to have to find the money to do this. I mean, we're a loose coalition of people all over the state none of us is making any money doing this. Where are we? I said to him, we don't have $10 million. I said, oh, come on, 6 or 7. So, yeah, I know, you know, but that's not, I mean, I don't know how we're going to get from where we are to there fast enough that we don't get, you know, frapped to death by that time.
Well, I think that you've started. Those of you who are across the state, you need your coalition that you're building. You need to be out talking to the public more.
We are. No, we can't do anymore. I mean, my business suffers because I work on fracking half the time. What we need is for more people to get involved.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you, you know, reach out to others and have and let them know what you're doing. You know, social media does wonders. Okay? So I would tell you that I'm sure that if you got onto social media, you would really find how many people are like-minded and feel the way you do about this whole issue. So let me just guide you in that direction, and I think you'll find that you'll get a lot of folks on your side. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Monica King from ChildNet.
Thank you. Well, Faith reached out and said you guys wanted to hear a little bit about human trafficking, so I have some materials that are being passed out. It's also known as commercially sexually exploited children, so I appreciate you guys asking about the topic. We have a really robust local task force that meets monthly. I see our chief probation officer, Cassandra, here, and there are members of DJJ, ChildNet, DCF, as well as many other providers, as well as PACE, who participate. And so wanted to provide you some information on human trafficking since you had asked. Since 2012, when there was sort of a lot of activity, we were identifying, it's not a lot of children, but it is a very concerning and very expensive population to take care of. So in 2012, and you can read that at your leisure, there were about 55 victim children that were identified through the abuse hotline. We are now, last year there were 75 victim children. The majority of them are community kids. They're not necessarily kids that are coming over to ChildNet or the dependency system, which has been sort of a swap. In the first couple of years, there were a lot of kids that were actually in the foster care system or entering the foster care system. That's really sort of flip-flopped. And a lot of those kids are still in the community, still linked to families, but are struggling with this issue. We're projecting this year to have probably about 100 victim children. We have gotten some money, Safe Harbor funding money, but what I wanted to sort of share is that to take care of one of these children in a facility costs about $9,000 a month. It's about $100,000 to take care of one human trafficking victim. So the allotment of money has been much appreciated, but it goes just nowhere to sort of take care of these children, I think, to the best of our ability, particularly when I shared with you on Tuesday how the child welfare system is just being overwhelmed with a huge number. I kind of wanted to segue a little bit. The back of the materials will show you that a lot of these kids, as they were identified, had 72% of them had a delinquency history, and over 85% had substance abuse, mental health, which brings me to sort of my most important topic of that from a child welfare system we're struggling with immensely, and it's our dually involved youth, our youth that have delinquency charges, and who are not necessarily, and I had a nice long conversation with our probation officer and our system that is dealing with delinquent youth, and kids not getting the services at the right time. And we've got parents who are literally abandoning their children, walking away because they're not getting the behavioral health services that they need, and they're really not progressing through the criminal justice system to get an intervention, and they're walking into the doors. And if I could have one more minute. I'm going to share a quick story. I've got a teen girl who's had charges, probably five aggravated battery charges in the last 4 years. And she's over in our dependency system. Her mom can't deal with her. The juvenile justice system is struggling to meet. They have really, really turned into a lot of their programs. You just have to have had such an extensive, you know, long history that that's kind of where we are. And that's one example. I've got 200 youth in the foster care system that have a delinquency history. You know, and I, you know, in many ways I feel sometimes Cassandra's hands are tied, and that the level of funding that I think really is needed on the delinquency side to serve some of these kids, as well as our behavioral health programs, who are discharging kids and parents don't know what to do, and then they're turning them over to the foster care system, and it's putting us in an extremely, extremely difficult position, and we are just not the most appropriate venue to have some of these children.
Thank you, Monica, for the presentation on human trafficking, and I want to let you know that the committee on children, families, and seniors are, we are working very, very desperately trying to find some kind of solution to the fact that we don't have a place here in Broward County that our youth can go to and be really, really away from, because this is a population that does not need to be in a group home with any other population. They need to be in a set-aside facility by themselves. And that, to me, is, you know, is uncomfortable that we do not have a place for these youth to go.
They need a specialized program that takes them out of that environment and that life that they've gotten used to.
Right, and to learn that 23% of these victims are male in the state of Florida. That was something that was very shocking to DCF, because they just knew the whole population, probably young ladies, but now to find out that we have a male population, 23% of the males throughout the state of Florida are self-involved victims of human trafficking, yes.
And I think one clarification, Representative Rogers, you said earlier group homes are not registered. So any group home that takes care of our children is absolutely licensed. It's licensed by the Department of Children and Families, and they have to have, they're absolutely registered. So I don't know if you were speaking of any adult or sober homes, or, but I just wanted to clarify, at least the homes that we contract with.
Thanks for clarifying, or maybe I need to further clarify.
Okay.
Do you know if they're registered in the local municipality so they know that at home is there?
Yeah, they have to have a zoning. They have to be registered with the city, absolutely. All have to have a certain amount of space between one group home and another group home. So they are filing with the city as part of their zoning.
So there's no group homes in any municipalities that's violating local ordinances, as far as you know.
That's violating what?
That might be violating local ordinances.
Violating local ordinances. There is a lot of activity. There's a lot of discussion about a particular shelter that's been licensed as a shelter for 30 years. But they have code enforcement violations, and we've been meeting with the city. It's a state-owned DCF-owned property. And from all of our oversight, they're running a license program, and they're running a program for youth that many of these youth, about 18 of them, come from Fort Lauderdale, and about a dozen of them have a very lengthy delinquency history. Sure.
Thank you very much, Monica. Anyone else have any questions or comments about? Cynthia Bocos, Health Policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and delegates. I'd like to start out with saying that there is nobody in this room that for the rest of their life will not have surgery and will not know anybody who has surgery. Having said that, I am actually appalled, and everyone I know is appalled, that I received notification from the Florida Department of Health last week that no probable cause was found to recommend my former doctor. I had cancer surgery as an outpatient for another giant seizure a year ago. Had a tumor, I'm glad I removed. All right, My doctor refused to service me within 24 hours of cancer surgery, and I'm over 60. That brings an LA refuse on top of everything. I got so sick at home, I had a hobble or crawl to the phone and then have a phone to bed. After one more investigation, the Florida Department of Health said, that's okay. So, having said that, and since the law says, and I agree, no doctor has to service you except for emergency. But I think we should change the law a little bit and add this. If a doctor agrees to give you planned surgery and agrees to accept monies for that surgery, he needs to provide care for the first 24 hours or provide a contact of an equally qualified and experienced doctor. Why? Because within the first 24 hours after any surgery, that's when infection comes in. Infection is the leading cause of death after surgery. It's not the surgeon, the anesthesiologist, it's the infection, and that's what happened to me. And I feel that since it's a life or death situation, if that doctor cannot either provide you service or provide an equally qualified, experienced doctor to provide you service during the first 24 hours of you, he needs to become in charge. It's a life or death situation. I would have died. I live alone with two cats. My cats don't use a phone. I had to literally crawl to the phone. I was stuck. It came over something like 2 o'clock in the morning. And the my doctor used to be in service. We need to change this. And we need to find out the Department of Health why that board panel said that service or lack of was okay. It's not okay by anybody's standards. Thank you. Captain, to anybody.
Thank you very much. Any comments, questions? Thank you very much for coming and presenting. Michael Rayner.
Hi, good evening. Michael Rayner, I just wanted to follow up on an issue last year that thankfully we were able to hold off the governor's office and the Surgeon General from going forward to open up the Florida statute on HIV criminalization and actually attempt to make the statute much worse than it currently is. Florida's isn't as bad as some of the other statutes that are around the nation, but the effort was being held up, and there may be an attempt by the governor's office to try to introduce legislation to open up 775.0877, which is the criminal transmission of HIV statute. On the statute, from a public health perspective, it's disincentive to HIV testing. May actually encourage non-disclosure among those who are living with HIV. Alienates patients from healthcare providers, does not deter the targeted behavior that is aimed to deter. It sends an inaccurate message regarding prevention responsibility for those who are actually engaged in sex. From a due process perspective, it's extremely difficult to prove HIV disclosure unless you really have a sign-in sheet on your nightstand that you're engaged in sexual intercourse with your partner. You know, it's basically he said, she said contest at that point. And I state he said, she said, because the statute currently only pertains, the state defines sexual intercourse as a penile penetration of the vagina. So the cases that have come forward would only pertain to heterosexual sexual intercourse. The cases generally ignore scientific evidentiary details, as it doesn't account for viral load and the advancements we know about HIV transmission these days and how to prevent transmission by with the advancements in medications. It results in disproportionate punishment. In terms of group harm, it stigmatizes all people living with HIV/AIDS. It makes, in many people's mind, HIV actually having it a crime. It ruins individuals' lives, oppresses and marginalizes populations of people, either most affected by HIV or those living with it. And in some cases, it's used as a coercive tool by the HIV negative partner in that situation. That's all my remarks for today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Serena, for coming and bringing those remarks. Are there any questions or comments?
Representative, basically, just the concern is in the event that the legislature should go forward with anything, just to be mindful, this is not a time where the HIV AIDS community would wish for that statue under the current climate in Tallahassee for that to be open to have any amendments, even if there are some good amendments.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Robin Figueroa.
My name is Robin Figueroa. I am the president and founder of an organization called the Vision of Redemption. And our goal is to help those who are being injured back into society. I had a few questions and was hoping that you all might be able to assist me or point me into the right direction, just to get more information. In recent months, President Obama spoke to the press regarding criminal justice reform. And I wanted to know what, if anything, is being done with the state of Florida regarding prison reform, and how can our organization be informed of any new developments regarding prison reform?
What you would have to do is to see if there's legislation that's going to be filed, just if you know of any legislation. You can go on to myflorida.gov and tracking the legislation, put in the subject matter and see if there are any bills that have been filed or there, you know, and speak to the legislators to find out if they know of any bills that are going to be filed. Just keep up with that so you'll know if something is filed, you'll be able to comment on it. All right? And as far as, what was the other question I think you had about, we knew any programs that were dealing with it?
Not if there were any programs, if anything was being developed in the state of Florida, and how could our organization be informed of any new developments? So that would just be me just keeping up on, like, meeting up on Florida, my Florida backup.
That's right. And also within the community, other organizations that may be doing some things that we don't even know about.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Sheriff Scott Israel, if you are in the building, this is your time. Right here early. You don't want time. I have something since 5:30. Okay, go right ahead, Sheriff.
Well, good afternoon. I know it can't be easy for you all to be up in Tallahassee with everything you guys put up with, and I know what the climate's like up there, so I want to first thank you on behalf of the Broward Sheriff's Office for everything you've done for us. I know you fight the fight and you brought us all money when we really didn't think you had any, so thank you, truly. I just wanted to answer any questions there might be, but I wanted to tell you about three things that we're asking for your support. And as you know, everything that we geared my administration to is two things, falls under the umbrella of two things: keeping kids out of jail and giving kids an opportunity to make something of themselves and have fruitful lives, and to put violent offenders in jail. So I come to you first to ask for your help in formulating an inmate portal. Approximately 2,500 prisoners are released from Florida prisons every year, and the recidivism rate amongst this group of people is about 66%. So we need a place to help these men and women re-enter society the right way so that they don't come back and lower the recidivistic rate. The stockade, as we call it, is the perfect place for this. We estimate the cost would be about $500,000 a year. Now, some people might say that's a lot of money. And I say this, you know, straightforwardly. That's an insignificant amount of money to lower our recidivistic rate and to make sure people don't become repeat felons and get jobs and can stay out in society and not cause problems. We need to have a place where we can link inmates to social services, where we can assess inmates, where we can criminally register inmates. So, first thing I ask is for the formulation of this inmate portal. Second thing is our JAC. This legislative body right here has done nothing but support us and support us and support us and support us. I don't know what more you can do. Everything we've asked, Representative Stark, Representative Rogers, Gwen, Evan, everything you've done has been to help us in our quest. So I really don't know what more you can do. You can't decide what a governor vetoes and what a governor doesn't veto. All we're asking is to fight this fight again, and we need a place where we can work without kids, we need more money, and the JAC is very important to us. And then lastly, I don't think that there's any elected official, or maybe even person in Broward County, that travels the county as much as I do, each day, each week, each month. A couple of folks that are here with me today would say I'm everywhere, and I try to be, because if you're going to ask people to support you, they need to see you, and they need to be able to ask questions, easy questions and hard questions. They need to be able to challenge you. That's how we learn. And there's not many issues that come up where Broward County is in agreement, from Pompano to West Park to Weston to Cooper City to Dayton, Parkland, everywhere. Broward County, like much of America, wants body cameras. I've been in law enforcement 36 years. We have to take advantage of this technology. People will tell you body cameras aren't perfect, and they're not. They'll tell you that they don't show perhaps the mood or something, and they don't. But they sure tell you something happened or didn't happen. If the police officer says, I never touched that guy, and on the body cam you see punching somebody, you know that's not truthful. You know if the prisoner says, I never reached for a gun, and you see him reaching for a weapon, you know what happened. Body cameras, two things are significant. You can never forget this. No matter what your view is on body cameras, there's two things that are significant that you can't forget. Citizens act more professionally when they know they're on camera. And police officers and deputies act more professionally when we know we're being filmed. It's a win-win. And as a sheriff, I want to know what happened. I want to see what happened. It's a very expensive proposition. The cameras and the hardware, they're not the meat and potatoes of this. And an agency our size, I probably need 11 full-time people for the next 150 years to manage this system, to memorialize things, to send out public records requests, to prepare the evidence, to redact information. But we have to take advantage of this technology. I think you'd all agree with me where I don't think you could come up with a more disturbing video, Representative Clark, than the one in South Carolina. We've seen a lot of disturbing videos in our day. But to see a man killed running away from a former police officer and shot multiple times in the back. And I tell you that if it wasn't for that camera, we're not even having this conversation. That guy reached for this, reached for that, went for a taser, and we're done. We've got to stand as a community. We've got to support the implementation of body cameras, and somebody's got to pay for it. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Sheriff Mitchell. Representative Rogers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to see you and good to have you here. I see you everywhere, I have to say, so it's good to have you here tonight. I recall reading some of this, all right? And maybe even recently, that federal government had allocated some funding for body cameras. Do you know of that? And did Broward County apply as a county? Did we apply as cities? How did we go about that process?
There were...
Excuse me, could you please identify yourself?
Ron Gunsberg, General Counsel for the Sheriff. There were federal grants, there was one round of them. The reality was, although it was $20 million nationwide, which by the way, $20 million nationwide is very, very little, for agencies our size, there only were two. And I believe it was a total of $1.5 million, which even that wouldn't have covered it. Ultimately, we didn't put in for that one because we're to start our pilot project. One of the requirements was you needed to be ready for full implementation, and 1.5 wouldn't even do the full implementation. So, it, under the rules that were written, it wasn't realistic. But we will look at $20 million, you're not saying $20 million nationwide. Yeah.
We need $20 million right here.
Not part of
it. Okay. You spoke about the inmate portal and using the use of the stockade. What is the problem with the stockade? Why can't you use the stockade?
As you might know, representatives, sheriffs in the state of Florida are not allowed to own property. All property, professionally, of course, all property is owned by that county. So we don't even own the building that's owned by Ms. Henry in the county. That stockade falls into that, and I've been told crystal that the county has no plans on funding the opening of that building. So, like,
okay. Yeah.
The one thing I will say, in fairness to the county, is the stockade will be used and is prepared to be used if there's ever an overflow in arrests. But since I've been sheriff, I've been keeping the population on any given day is about 84 or 85%. So we're not close to that. God willing, we won't ever be close. And there's a lot of room in that facility that can be used for social service programs and people who need help.
Okay. So the county owns the building. Is there anything going on in the building now?
Just there's an area where we would have an overflow for inmates. We need, you know, because we, by federal mandate, we have to have this.
But at this time, you don't have that overflow, so you are not using the facility. Is anyone else using the facility?
Right. They're willing to let us request, but they haven't approved anything.
They are willing to let you request the use of the facility if you have need of it with the overflow population. Is that correct?
For overflow, they said that is their primary use. They're holding it for overflow purposes, for a correctional facility. Anything else they see as an extra use, we know one of the commissioners right now wants to do some mental health services there. The other commissioners and county administration don't seem currently on board with that yet, because again, they're holding it if they ever need to reactivate it, but the buildings are there. It's a logical site.
Ron, can you just say yes or no? Is anything going on in the building now?
On that site, the answer would be one outbuilding, I believe, we're using for some office space. I don't believe the other buildings are being used for anything right now, other than, I mean, the only thing that I see happening, the yes it happens, is the county does allow us, goes to them, not us, to rent it out for film and TV companies that want to film things there for the day they pay the county a fee, but beyond that, it's not being used.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Oh, you have a follow-up? Sheriff, first of all, thank you for your stance on body cameras. I know that here in Broward and the citizenry here, it seems like something that makes common sense, but I know in comparison to some other folks in your same position in other counties, that you're out on a limb, and the people of Broward deserve to know that they have a sheriff that's willing to do the right thing and step out on that limb, really by yourself. And what I wanted to know is this. How do we engage these other high-ranking law enforcement officials throughout the state of Florida to get them to see the same way that you and I see it from what your description just was of a program like this? I try to emphasize the benefit of, you know, the camera goes to mine. you know, like you said, you never videotape a mood, but when you have a definitive yes or no type of question, did something happen or did it not, the video will exonerate or will condemn, and it'll be the truth at the end of the day, and that's what I think everyone wants to see more than anything else. Any advice on how to engage these folks from other parts of the state that may not see it the same way that you and myself, and I don't speak for anybody, but a lot of this delegation does?
You know, that's such a fair question and such a hard question. The folks, without mentioning any names, the officials and heads of law enforcement agencies that I have encountered that are against it, the one common denominator is they bring up their unions, and this is not a popular, you know, this is not a popular issue with the police unions around the state. But I'll say this, as I said to a county representative, we don't let the students tell the teachers and the principals what to do. We don't let the players tell the coaches and managers what to do. I've been in law enforcement 37 years almost. I'm the sheriff of Broward County. I'm the leader, and I know what's best for this county and our men and women. And we need body counts. And the community.
Thank you very much, Sheriff Israel. Any other questions to the sheriff or comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had one comment, and that's that I've been watching Sheriff Israel since before he was Sheriff Israel, and it's nice to hear people who live up to the campaign promises, which were to really work on recidivism, and I just really wanted to commend you on that. Just, you know, going to take a look at this and see if there's anything we can do about stockade. I don't know if we can, but certainly want to take a look at it, because I really appreciate that you're, you know, you really are real on this and been trying to take care of this.
I know if there's anything that can be done, this group will get it done. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sheriff.
And then you all have a great day, Charles.
Thank you, too. All right. I'd like to recognize some of my colleagues, staff members who are here, representative staff members, colleagues who are not here, from Shepherd Jones' office, Devon Campbell, from Katie Edwards' office. What's his name, Corey?
George.
I don't know, you look like a Corey to me. Okay, I don't know why. Everything's going to tell happy I do that to you. But thanks, and from Brett Rogers' office, Pat Young, and from my office, Eric Gooden. All right, delegation staff. Executive Director Andrea Knowles and Administrative Coordinator Faith. And Jean, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
All right. Are there any other comments to be made by anyone? And I see that Cassandra, you're here from DJJ. I didn't know whether you wanted to make a comment or anything. Just listening. All right. Thank you very, very much. And thanks to all of our law enforcement officers for being here. Yes, Michael?
Michael Rader, again. I just wanted to thank the members for last year. I know when Representative Martillis brought forward the legislation to ban access for transgender people to use the restrooms. I saw from an email from the Christian Family Coalition that they're gearing up for that again this next session, and I just want to thank you so much for all of your support. Here in Broward County, transgender people do have those protections to use the restrooms of their relating to their gender identity, which has been misreported by Representative Martillis in Tallahassee time and time again when he speaks on it. So I just want to reaffirm that to you, and thank you so much for that support of making sure that the dignity of every person is protected.
Something that I'll do from time to time when there's a bill that I find particularly ugly and that I just don't care for, that I think is paid for on purpose, when it doesn't pass 1 year, I will quietly put it into drafting the following year, not to file the bill, but to get an alarm of sorts, a tripwire of sorts, to know if the bill is going to be filed. That bill is in drafting right now by someone who plans on filing it. It is coming back. The one thing I think everybody should always remember about that, any of the hypotheticals that have ever been laid out as to why this bill may or may not be necessary, or may be necessary, is already covered under some other portion of the law. It literally does nothing but demonize a minority in our community, which is constantly demonized already for no good reason other than misunderstanding. So just be aware the fight's going to be back on, but I know you have a lot of supporters up here that are more than willing to get messy on that fight.
I do know that the entire delegation, with the exception of Representative Rouse, who was a co-sponsor of that bill, was definitely one who was showed common sense in that, and it's unfortunate that even he goes against the grain of the county in which he represents. In that, and I certainly, if you want, maybe mention to Representative Morales that if he wants to learn more, Southern Comfort Conference is going to be at the Bonaventure Hotel at the end of this month. It's the largest transgender conference in the nation that's here in Brevard County for the next 3 years. They have a contract. So certainly, if he wants to learn more, engage people before attacking them, he certainly can go there and meet with them. To learn more about how and why it's such an unjust thing, or maybe even listen to the Pope's message today. Thank you,
Michael. I would recommend the conference of last year. It's at the Riverside.
You know, this conference is the first time ever that it's
in Western.
Yeah, I think what you may have been to was the Transgender Medical Symposium.
I think that's probably
what this conference has several hundreds attending, if not thousands, from all over the country. It used to be in Atlanta every year, and this year it's actually in the Bonaventure Hotel in Weston.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for your participation and interest this evening. Our next meeting will be our local bill public hearing. And members, please reach out to your colleagues and tell them that we need a quorum for that meeting. We will be voting on the local bills that have gone before the legislature this year. That's Tuesday, September 29th. And it's at the Governmental Center in Fort Lauderdale. After this meeting, the delegation will be having workshops. And these are also open to the public to attend. However, the public will not be given a chance to participate. A full schedule of public hearings and workshops is available on the table in the back. If you have any questions, please feel free to see Faith Lombardo or Andrea Knowles in reference to the public hearing. Thank you very much for coming. This meeting is adjourned.